Today on the 21st.
This is a historic visit, and it's a historic opportunity to engage directly with the Cuban people.
President Obama, along with several of our elected officials from Illinois, are in Cuba. Here's Representative Sherry Bustos, who signed on legislation in the hopes of helping Illinois companies.
So they can buy our beans and our corn and our hogs and our cattle and also our John Deere tractors and our Caterpillar earth moving equipment for that matter.
What does this trip mean for us here in Illinois? Plus, how a turtle named Sam is helping Springfield students learn STEM skills.
We got to see what we wanted to on paper come alive because it was really cool.
That's fifth grader Reagan Grundy. We'll hear from her Du Bois elementary school teacher and the researchers who developed the software Reagan's been working on. That's all this hour on the 21st. Stay with us. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Right now, President Obama is meeting with Cuban President Raul Castro. It's all part of his historic trip to the island. Before the embargo, U.S. agricultural exports to Cuba were worth about $600 million a year in today's prices. Others estimate that Cuba's a $1.2 billion market for agricultural exports, if that's the big if, the embargo and other trade barriers are lifted. Joining us now on the line from Cuba is Charlie Serrano. He's a Chicago businessman who's been working for decades to nurture relationships between Americans and Cubans with an eye for Illinois business. Charlie, good morning. Welcome to the 21st.
Good morning, and a big hello to all Illinoisans listening to us.
Now, tell us, you are in Havana right now. What are you seeing right now?
I'm in Havana. I just got done. The president was at the Martí Memorial. He had just laid out a wreath, and there was an honor guard, and it was just very emotional to hear the national anthem and the Cuban national anthem playing, and one right after another, and then they were going to sit down for some meetings. He has a full schedule today, which includes later on a presentation at a theater of a selected group of folks inside the theater. It was raining yesterday.
Yeah, Charlie, I saw that. So lots of rain when the president arrived as he was coming down off of the plane. I wonder, you've worked with companies who are interested in doing business with Cuba. What's at stake for Illinois right now with the president's visit?
I think what the president's visit does is to send a very powerful message, more so of a psychological message to the Cuban people, that this president and this administration is not the monster and the person and representing the nation that is antagonistic towards them. This has been a real war, a real embargo for 54 years, that the Cuban people directly feel that impact. What this does, Obama getting off that plane with his two daughters and Michelle and his mother-in-law, is extremely emotional. It's extremely breaking down those psychological barriers that have always permeated in the Cuban society, that no one ever believes, and for my 22 years here living in Havana, that no one ever believes that this is change or that this is going to be different or anything like that. But now that takes that major step.
So for you, Charlie, when we think about the decades of work you've done between here, between Illinois and Cuba, and thinking in particular of when Governor Ryan went to Cuba, do you see this moment with President Obama, and I should add the congressional delegation, which includes a significant portion of Illinois lawmakers, Senators Durbin, Representative Schakowsky, Bustos, Robin Kelly, among some lawmakers who are there, do you see this as a different moment?
Totally, totally. I think Illinois held a favorite nation status with Cuba. In 1999, we planned and organized that trip for our governor, 92 people. It was tremendous, historic impact, that particular mission. And I believe one of the things that happened from there was that it gave us access. It gave the folks in Illinois access that no one else had into Cuba. I think what this does right now is that what the firms that we have brought over to Cuba, they have built relationships. And this is a Caribbean island nation. It is a nation of relationships. It's not one of quid pro quo, I'm going to give you this, you're going to give me so many tons of that. I mean, Cuba has been known to pay a higher price for rice in Louisiana because they're purchasing from African-American rice growers. So their greater concern is one of building relations. And I think with the Illinois congressional delegation and our president that is from Illinois, and including Michelle Obama, who is going to continue our relationship with Cuba, what's of most value here is that we build these relationships.
Charlie, let me ask you let me ask you one last question about that. As you talk about relationships, we know that I'm just in particular thinking about one specific example of the hospitality industry. Starwood signed a deal over the weekend to manage a few hotels in Cuba, and we saw this news this morning that the company's merger with Marriott now looks imminent. So I wonder, what does this mean for Hyatt Hotels and Hyatt's interest in having those business relationships in Cuba?
The folks from Hyatt have had communications and building relations with the folks in Cuba here, I would dare to say, for almost a decade. There are various occasions the Hyatts and folks from the Cuban embassy, which used to be the intersection, we mediated some of those meetings. I think the numbers stack up the following. Cuba has about 60,000 hotel rooms. The city of Chicago probably has 60,000 hotel rooms. Cuba needs to build in the next 7 to 8 years 75 to 80,000 hotel rooms just to match with the projections today. Islands like Puerto Rico, Dominican Republic, it would get 5 to 7 million visitors. Cuba is still barely at 2 million. And you can fit Puerto Rico inside Cuba 14 times. Cuba with 10 million visitors is still... It still is not a high number for the size and the 8 massive tourist attractions that Cuba has, with over 2,200 keys in the northern part that are just spectacularly gorgeous.
It is. Charlie, I'm going to stop you there.
So
thank
the
you.
Numbers,
yeah.
So the numbers stack up to a place like the state of Illinois that has so many industries that feed so much of the hotel hospitality industry. Just tell me in the greater Chicago area what restaurant supply you cannot find.
Sure.
So neat,
Charlie,
there.
It sounds like your line's breaking up. So I'm going to stop you there and say thank you so much for joining us. From Havana, Charlie Serrano is managing director of the Chicago company Antilles Strategies Group. As you heard him, he works with companies who want to do business with Cuba. Joining us on the line. Thanks for talking with us, Charlie. You know, Charlie mentioned hospitality. We want to talk about what an open Cuba means for all Illinois businesses and for the Illinois economy, particularly with an eye to agriculture. We're going to be talking about that later on the hour. So here's my question to those of you listening. If opening Cuba could affect you or your business, does this give you an opportunity? Or if you have questions about all of this, you can give us a call. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. You can always tweet us. Our handle is 21st Show. Joining us now from Chicago is Gary Marks. He was the first Tribune reporter to be based in Havana. Gary, welcome to the 21st. Gary, are you there? Okay, it looks like we're having a hard time getting a hold of Gary. As I said, our show today is about President Obama's trip to Cuba, and we are going to be talking to a couple of different groups, to businessmen, to agriculture. And my question to you is, if you were interested in doing business with Cuba, give us a call. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. Or you can tweet us. Our handle is 21st Show. You know, when you think about Cuba and the amount of dollars that is involved with the agricultural market in particular, we're talking about, when we look at what agricultural exports to Cuba used to be. Before the embargo, about $600 million a year. That's in today's prices. And others are estimating that Cuba right now is a $1.2 billion market for agricultural exports. So when we're talking about this, it's a great opening for Illinois companies. And right now, there's actually already some exceptions to medical and agricultural products that are being allowed to go onto the island. When we think about the delegation that's going on right now, we have Senator Dick Durbin, Congressman Jan Schakowsky, Representative Sherry Bustos, all of those who are part of the president's historic trip to Cuba. You're listening to The 21st Show, and on the line with us right now is Gary Marks. Gary, are you there? Gary, can you hear me? Okay, it looks like we're having a hard time getting a hold of Gary. Gary, can you hear me now?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yes, there we go.
Oh, great. Okay.
So, Gary, you were the first Chicago Tribune reporter to be based in Havana. You were there for about 5 years, I think,
yes.
Between 2002 and 2007. I wonder what you thought, what you felt yesterday watching President Obama land in Cuba. What do you think? What did it all mean for you?
Well, obviously, it was a historic trip. It was amazing seeing Air Force One land at Jose Marti Airport. And, you know, many of us who have been following Cuba for decades really thought that would never happen. I mean, we imagined that one day it would, but for Obama actually and the First Lady to step off the plane, it was pretty amazing. Again, but that doesn't mean that everything has changed overnight. Obviously, it's a historic trip. Obviously, you know, the president wants to improve relations with Cuba, but this is a long and complicated and very fraught history between the two countries.
Well, and when you say that, Gary, I should note to our listeners who are probably just getting to know me that I am from Miami. That's where I was born and raised. I have a degree in Latin American and Caribbean studies, and my family is also from the Caribbean. So I understand sort of the context of this very well. And I think it's very interesting to think about the part of the world that I grew up in is South Florida. The whole lens in which South Florida views Cuba is so different from the rest of the U.S.
Yeah.
And I wonder, Illinois has played a really unique perspective in this. When we were talking to Charlie Serrano earlier, he was talking about George Ryan's trip. I wonder what you think Governor Ryan's visit, if you can explain a little of the historical significance of that and how you think that reflects Illinois' attitude towards Cuba.
Well, of course, you know, Miami is, you know, it's the home of hundreds of thousands of Cuban Americans who fled the island after the revolution and obviously fled the island again in mass during the Mariel boat lift and tens of thousands after that. So that's Miami kind of is separate in some ways from the rest of the country. Illinois doesn't have that history. You know, we have a much smaller Cuban American population here. And really when George Ryan went, his trip obviously was historic, the first sitting governor to go since the revolution. To Havana. It was 1999, and he went there as really as an ambassador for Illinois businesses. And as you had mentioned before I was able to get on air about the exception to the Cuban embargo, which allowed Cuba to purchase in cash, not with credit, but in cash, both medical and agricultural goods, that kind of gave an opening for Illinois. So, you know, Illinoisans, I think, see Cuba in a different way. We don't, you know, see Fidel Castro in the same light as obviously Cuban American immigrants in from Miami. We see it more as a business opportunity. Obviously, we have, you know, ADM here. We have the Illinois Corn Growers Association, who went with Governor Ryan on the trip. So we see it more as a business opportunity. The same sort of argument of, well, we trade with China and China was our enemy for many years. Why can't we do the same thing with this island nation, this small island nation, you know, 90 miles off our coast?
And Gary, let me ask you, how much do you think this political opening is because of the state that the Cuban economy is in right now?
Oh, I think it's absolutely tied to the desperate state of the Cuban economy. I mean, I think over the years, Havana has shown and the Castro brothers have shown that, you know, they open up when they really have to open up. The first time they did this was after the collapse of the Soviet Union in the 1990s, which absolutely devastated the Cuban economy. Cuba was getting billions of dollars a year in subsidies from the Soviet Union. And when Mikhail Gorbachev pulled that aid away, the Cuban economy went into a free fall. And that was a time that they were forced to kind of open up and allow limited private enterprise. They also began opening up a little bit to foreign investment. And, you know, since that time, they have opened and closed the economy based on how well they're doing. In recent decades, when I was down there, the economy was being bankrolled to a large extent by Hugo Chavez and free oil, Venezuelan oil. They were getting over 100,000 barrels free a day from Venezuela. And now, of course, the Venezuelan economy is tanking.
I was
going to
say that.
Oil is
gone
down.
Now,
exactly.
Right. So how much do you – here's the question then, because here's the big question. We just have about a minute left.
Okay.
Do you think this will lead – do you think President Obama's trip leads to long-term change?
Nyla, I don't think anybody knows. I think anybody who says they know really doesn't know. Raul Castro, we know, based on his history, he believes in a one-party political system, and he believes in socialism. So I would say as long as Raul Castro is in control and those around him are in control, which are primarily former military people, I would say no. But you never know. You never know. And like I said, it's kind of a wait and see thing at this point.
And how much do you think this changes the balance sheet of our biggest companies here? We heard Charlie Serrano talking earlier about hotel rooms. We're going to be speaking in a few minutes to Caterpillar.
Right.
How much?
Well, I think it provides an opening to U.S. companies. But again, Cuba is a poor country, 12 million people, I believe. It's not a gigantic market, but any market that U.S. companies and Illinois companies can secure is obviously a benefit to us.
That's Gary Marks. He's now an investigative reporter with the Chicago Tribune. Joining us on the line from Chicago, former Havana Bureau Chief. Gary, thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Nyla. It was a pleasure.
As you heard Gary mention the Illinois Corn Growers Association, we're going to be speaking to them after the break, as well as Caterpillar and others about what business opportunities they see on the island. Here's my question for those of you listening. If you think Cuba is an opportunity for you or your business, give us a call. You can also tweet us. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455, or you can tweet us. Our handle is @21stshow. Stay tuned. Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Today we're talking Cuba and Illinois. What does it mean for Illinois Ag and for some of our biggest companies? Here's U.S. Representative Sherry Bustos, who's in Havana right now. We spoke with her before she left.
As soon as I heard the announcement from President Obama that he wanted to take a look at improving our relations with Cuba, my mind went to agriculture and our growers and our producers. I said, I want to go to Cuba and I want to start laying the foundation where our family farmers can benefit from improved trade. So we went last October and came home. I immediately signed on to some legislation that would give the Cubans access to credit so they can buy our beans and our corn and our hogs and our cattle and also our John Deere tractors and our Caterpillar earth-moving equipment, for that matter.
That's Representative Sherry Bustos. She spoke with Will Ag's Todd Gleason before she left for Cuba for her second trip. And speaking of Caterpillar, the company's director for Latin America joins us on the line now from Miami, Marco Salowitz. Welcome to the 21st.
Thank you, Nyla. I appreciate the opportunity to be here with you.
Marcos, you know, Caterpillar has a long history in Cuba, and I wonder if you could tell us what business was like before the embargo for Caterpillar in Cuba.
You know, we did have a dealership appointed in Cuba before the embargo, and we sold equipment there until the embargo took place. But most importantly, right, is we haven't been selling product there, obviously, because of the embargo. But since 1998, we've been very active in calling for the end of the embargo and for working with the Congress and all the administrations on policy changing to make sure that we do have, when the opportunity comes, we do have the opportunity to start selling products in Cuba.
And Marcos, before we get to the policy change, because I do want to ask you about those lobbying efforts, I understand that Caterpillar has been involved in some philanthropic efforts since the embargo. What have you all done?
Absolutely. In the 1998 timeframe, we donated several generators to hospitals in Cuba, in Havana. And most recently, we announced a donation between Caterpillar Inc. and Caterpillar Foundation for the Hemingway House in Cuba. It's an effort to help them with the cultural aspects of Hemingway House, and we basically made a donation of $500,000 that has been recently announced.
How else have you all laid the groundwork to maintain those relationships in Cuba?
We have been going to Cuba quite frequently, as a matter of fact. We recently had several people going in the U.S. and Cuba Business Council there. Our vice president for public affairs went there when the embassy was open. I have been there a couple times, and I'm going again to Cuba this next week. And the whole idea is to stay in touch, is to learn, and to be able to see how Caterpillar can help the people in Cuba.
And you know, Marcus,
As a matter of fact, on this trip that I'm going on next week, we are taking with us our dealership that has recently appointed for Cuba, Rinco Power, which is a dealership that's located in Puerto Rico. And I will be taking them with us, and we plan to visit the Mario port as well as talk to several officials in Cuba.
And Marcos, you know, Caterpillar, of course, is a global company and does business all over the world. What unique challenges do you think will present for doing business with Cuba, if and when that's allowed?
You know, I think the biggest challenge that's going to be ahead of us is how much willing Cuba is to ease in the business and being friendly business with the United States. Assuming that would happen, I think financing is one that we need to make sure that it takes place, as well as investments in the country, right? I think the success of the Cuban government as well as Caterpillar in Cuba is directly related to our ability or the government's ability to capture some investments and being able to invest in infrastructure, mining, and basically all the products that Caterpillar produces and would be willing to sell and partner with the Cuban government.
And that said, of course, none of that can happen for you all. We mentioned before the break for some of our listeners, there are some restrictions lifted for agricultural and medical products. Caterpillar does not fall under that category. Legally, you all cannot do business in Cuba unless the embargo is lifted, which requires congressional approval. So all of that is to ask you, what kind of efforts you all have been doing lobbying in Washington to change that?
Absolutely. What we have been doing, and, you know, granted, it's a very slow process, right? We have been talking to all the congressmen and congresswomen in Washington, D.C., to make sure that we make our case, and we clearly communicate that the current policy has not been working, right? It's clear. As a matter of fact, it's heartbroken for me as I went to Cuba this last time, and I can see every single brand of equipment.
European brands, right, but no American ones, right?
And then it's clear that the current policy is not working and we need to do something different and engaging with people in Cuba. You are absolutely right on your statement. We cannot sell in Cuba until the embargo is lifted. But what we're trying to do proactively is, like I said, we named a dealership in Cuba. We are working on all the internal processes for Caterpillar that would enable us to sell immediately once the embargo is lifted, as well as all the work that's been done by our public affairs team with the Washington congressmen and congresswomen on trying to address our concerns and really work with the people in Cuba.
Marcos, one last question for you. How soon can Caterpillar be ready to go if the embargo was lifted? It sounds like you guys
are
ready. You're ready now. Okay.
We are ready to go. And like I said, the reason why we're going next week, right, is another piece of work in our research to be 100% sure that once the embargo is lifted, we can partner with the people in Cuba and with the government there to ensure we can start selling our equipment there.
Marcos Salowitz is Caterpillar's Director for Latin America, joining us from Miami. Marcos, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Nyla. I appreciate the opportunity.
I want to go now to two farmers and to switch to the agricultural sector, to Ted Modis, who's with the Illinois Corn Growers Association and a full-time family farmer, along with Lynn Worshab, who has 2,500-acre Worshab Farms and is also part of the Illinois Soybean Association. And Lynn, Ted, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you.
Lynn, let's start with you. What would it mean for Illinois soybean farmers if relations were normalized?
Basically, if relations were normalized, it would mean that the soybean farmers of Illinois and also the U.S. would have a chance to market their soybeans to the natives there in Cuba, and it would give us another market to where we could send the soybeans that we grow, since we are a state that is logistically located in a great position to be able to send our commodities to other countries. And since we are so close to Cuba, we would be able to get our soybeans there at a timely rate. And then in turn, since we would be able to be shipping our soybeans to another country, and that potentially that could create higher prices and more market-driven demand for our product.
Mm-hmm. Ted, I wonder how much, I mean, well, that was Lynn talking about soy. I wonder when we think about corn, how much, I wonder if you could explain something for our listeners. We've mentioned a couple times that right now there are some agricultural products that are being allowed to be exported. I imagine corn and soy are among those right now, Ted?
Well, on a limited basis, there was a time when there were more bushels sent, but currently it's very, very minimal. And a lot of that has to do, of course, with the embargo, but the part of the embargo that frees money or allows the Cuban government to get money to purchase, and right now they don't have any.
So it's really right now what's tying it up isn't necessarily the agricultural restriction, it's the banking restriction, right, Ted?
That is a very, very major one. When I was listening to Lynn talk, everything that she said, I'd have to ditto, because we're looking at the same opportunities as soy.
And let's talk about numbers for this. Ted, I mean, what do you think in terms of numbers you're expecting and if you could put on sort of your Illinois Corn Growers Association hat, what kind of numbers are we looking at potentially in a Cuban market for Illinois farmers?
Oh, my gosh, that's a very difficult number to come up with. I don't know if I can give you a number, but what I would give you is an important aspect of corn, and that is not only are we looking at corn, we're looking at co-products of corn, mm-hmm. also. So corn is just part of it. I can see us sending distillers dried grain there. I can see us sending or potential sending ethanol there. There's a lot of other possibilities.
Right.
Too.
So it's just an ancillary market. Right. Lynn, what about for soy? What kind of numbers are you thinking about?
Basically, the numbers could be pretty huge, and a lot of the numbers that we have has corn and soybeans commingled together, where last year in April, Texas A&M had actually did a survey and some research to where they were trying to figure out what the potential export capabilities would be for corn and soybeans into Cuba, and they related that to the U.S. Senate Committee for Agriculture, Nutrition, and Forestry. And they were saying that potentially the export potential could be over $1 billion annually.
Wow.
If the embargo
right.
restrictions are lifted.
And now, of course, that's the whole broad market for the whole country. I wonder, Lynn, if you can provide perspective people for Illinois soy. What do you think that means? Lynn, are you there?
Yes, I'm sorry. Oh. My phone kind of cut out.
Oh, that's okay.
There.
Go ahead.
I don't have an actual number, a dollar figure, but I do know that about 20% of the Illinois crop is exported to Cuba.
Mm-hmm. Right now. Okay, wow. So for you all, I mean, I wonder if I can just ask both of you, because both of you have visited Cuba in the past. Lynn, I wonder if I could start with you about what struck you most when you visited Cuba. First, I want to just ask from a business standpoint how you felt about it.
That's a very good question. When I first got there, I realized the extreme potential that country holds for infrastructure and technology and for quality food supply and different day-to-day things that we kind of take for granted up here in the States, and that there is so much potential there. And I was just really shocked at the lack of the infrastructure and different things such as restaurants and convenience stores. And one of the big things when you walk out of the airport there is that you are literally stepping back in time. It is like you were in 1950s, late 1940s America, where you're seeing all the old
cars.
You
see it in the cars on the streets, right.
Yes, mm-hmm. It's quite an eye-opening experience, but there is so much potential in that country, and they could greatly increase their ability as a country to function with just some help with just a little bit of technology resources and road infrastructure and the ability to get a safe and more quality and consistent food supply.
Ted, one last question for you. When you visited Cuba in the fall, I understand you were speaking with different restaurant owners about trade between the U.S. and Cuba. I wonder what they told you and how that sort of has impacted what you think about doing business in Cuba.
Well, the one place we went to was a place where they basically it was a university where they taught how to run a restaurant, how to run a resort type thing. And the thing that really struck me was the quality of the food that they had to work with. One of their goals is to develop their tourism business, and to have good tourism business, they got to have quality food. And I'll give them credit. They did a good job with what they had, but they don't have a lot. They don't have a lot to work with. And I have to go along with Lynn. When you step off that airplane and get into the Havana airport and get outside, it is a step back in time. And I remember those days. I remember 1959, 1960 when this all started, and they are frozen in that time. I look upon our involvement with Cuba, especially in the food end of it, is almost a humanitarian effort. Not only do we look at agree with everything that's been said about trade, that's extremely important to us. We need all the more outlets we can get, but these people need everything. There was a water main leak in a major highway in Havana, and they fixed the water main, but they didn't fill the hole because they didn't have money for the gravel to go back in the hole. I mean, it is just absolutely incredible.
Well, and I'm thinking about that. I've been to Cuba once, and it was about 15 years ago, and it sounds exactly the way you all described it from last fall. And I wonder, both of you, as we're talking about your trips there, and then your sort of perspective is you have both the hat of sort of both from the farm perspective and from the American perspective. I wonder what you think would be the biggest challenges as we look at this, if this opening, you know, there's a lot of ifs involved in this equation, if this will actually happen. But if you all had the chance to export more, what do you think would be the toughest part about that?
I think the toughest part about it would probably be to teach them how to use what we would be sending there. I mean, we went to a dairy farm where, number one, they only milk once a day, and the reason why they milk once a day is they don't have a good enough diet to sustain the development of milk. I mean, they are probably 1940s when it comes to technology and utilization of food. So we'd have to start from the beginning. Also, we'd have to probably, and they are working on this, developing their where they unload ships or to handle ships. So they're working on that. They're absolutely starting from scratch. What it really proved to me is how that governmental system does not and did not work.
We just have about a minute left, and Ted, I want to ask this one last question to you. When you think about that, when you think about critics who say, why should we be doing business with a regime that is repressive, that does not, you know, there were people who were rounded up before the president came. He was supposed to meet with them tomorrow. What do you think about American companies doing business what would you say to critics who say we shouldn't be doing business with a regime like
that? Well, I served in Vietnam, and it didn't take very long for us to go and become trade partners with them. I cannot see why, and I know the passion. We hear it, especially from presidential candidates whose family came from Cuba. I have no idea at all what they went through, but I think it's time for bygones to be bygones, to be kind of trite in that statement. I think when I looked at the hotel, when I stood and looked across the water and thought, 90 miles, why in the world can't we trade with a country 90 miles away who really need the product, who really need everything that we have? It's like I said before, it's a major humanitarian effort, if nothing else.
Thanks for joining us. That's Ted Modis with the Illinois Corn Growers Association. His family farm is in Elmwood near Peoria. Thanks also to Lynn Rorscheib. Her family is farms just east of Champaign and Fairmont. Thanks for being with us, guys. This This is the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. On Friday, we heard about a program that's using 3D printing to help rural schoolgirls get more interested in math and science. The surprising thing was we learned that two-thirds of our Illinois students are lagging behind their counterparts nationwide in science and math skills. Part of the problem is that math and science aren't mandated at the elementary school level, which also means there just isn't enough curriculum for teachers. An Illinois State University team is trying to change that with mapping software they've been getting into elementary schools in Springfield, working with almost 300 fourth and fifth graders. It turns out students are learning so much more than just how to map things. Here's Du Bois Elementary fifth grader Reagan Grundy.
We had to make sure that we weren't too close to any cities, but we also had to make sure that there weren't any other animals that could harm Sam.
That's Sam the turtle. Joining us now from WGLT in Bloomington Normal is project leader May Jadala, an associate professor of education, and also Jonathan Thane, an associate professor of geography. We're also joined by Reagan's teacher, Shannon McLeod, who teaches fifth grade at Du Bois Elementary School in Springfield. Thanks for joining us, all of you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Jonathan, let's start with you. I understand this whole project started with a box turtle named Buttons, but maybe that you can get us from Buttons to Sam. How does that work?
Well, I'm not sure it's a direct route, but I can tell you about Buttons.
Okay.
I have a friend in the biology department who found a three-toed ornamental box turtle on the sidewalk in downtown Bloomington. And he thought leaving that turtle there on the street was probably not going to be conducive to the turtle's long-term health. So he came to me and said, you have children, would you like a pet box turtle? So I brought it home, and my four kids were excited. We played with him for a weekend, probably her, actually, for a weekend. And we were reading online how to take care of box turtles, and every website had a statement that said something like, if you find a wild box turtle, you should leave it in the wild because that's where they're happiest. And after reading half a dozen of those websites, my kids decided we needed to let Buttons go.
So, oh, okay. And then how did you figured out you needed to find an appropriate home for Buttons.
Well, yeah, I knew I didn't want to go put her back in the street where she had been before, right? So I'm a geography professor, so some maps. We'd explored the area a little bit. We read about turtles, and we finally made a decision to release the turtle in the Howard Virgin Forest stand near our house so that we could go visit her again if we wanted to. She's good at hiding. We've gone back several times, but we haven't seen her.
But you think she's still there?
Yeah.
May.
Yeah, I'm optimistic that she's doing fine, yes.
Okay. May, how did this story and the Button story and the turtle mapping lead to creating this different curricula that you've done for these classrooms?
Well, it started with the maps that Jonathan created with the box turtle in mind. And we felt that was a fabulous learning opportunity or module for the students to interact with. However, we had to make other modules that were less sophisticated and easier for the students to interact with. We started with basic set theory concepts, meaning intercept, union, and buffer. Those are basic set theory functions that the program really uses when the students interact with the maps. So we started with very simple modules, and then we built the complexity up to box turtle, and finally to a bighorn sheep that was needed a relocation in Utah.
And so, Shannon, how have you used this in your classroom?
Well, we were lucky enough to be accepted to use this program through ISU. So they came in last fall, and we spent about 6 weeks, and we did lessons every single day in my classroom around module 1, 2, 3, and 4.
And what kind of skills did the students learn in those modules?
Well, of course, like May said, they used the main four tools. But more than that, the thing that I was most excited about was just seeing how the kids were able to find, you know, they were presented with these problems in each module. They had to find a solution, go and apply it within the program, analyze it, manipulate the data around, and then to see it displayed on their computer screen, that was the neatest part for them and me.
And when the students, we've talked about the skills that they're learning. They're not just learning mapping skills. They're learning spatial skills. And Jonathan, I wonder if you can sort of explain for us what spatial skills actually are.
Sure. So the ability to think spatially is really to think in three dimensions, is relationships, proximity. How close am I to something that that I need or that I need to avoid, right? And there are lots of things that games and puzzles and playground games that involve spatial thinking, but we don't really teach it as an academic discipline. We don't teach it as a necessary skill set in elementary schools.
Mm-hmm. And I wanted to ask you, because we hear so much about, you know, as Jonathan's talking about this, why STEM education is so important. And I wonder what lessons you've learned from developing this curriculum, in particular about how you think we should be better teaching science, technology, and math, especially to elementary school students.
To start with, we have a number of results based on the data that you collected from the students. We found that the students were able to do significantly better on the National Assessment for Educational Progress using the geography items. And we realized from the current data set that we have that the students who went through the program scored significantly better than the students in the controlled classrooms. And they also did much better on transfer activities that reflected their spatial visualization and relation, meaning that students were able to mentally manipulate, twist, and invert maps. They were also able to connect locations, compare maps, overlay and dissolve maps, and realize spatial distributions and patterns. Those skills, as Jonathan said, are typically not taught in schools, and the fact that working with the GIS program allowed them to develop these skills and showed those significant results in our tests.
Shannon, I wonder if I can ask you, as they're talking about these skills and these programs, what other opportunities that your students would have to learn these skills? That's probably something that doesn't really exist right now in any other curriculum. Am I right?
You are right. I mean, we do the best we can with the technology that's available to us. So we do, try to incorporate that as much as we can. But, you know, the reality is they don't get a lot of, hands-on with this kind of, problem-solving and skills and the geospatial reasoning and all that. So that's why this program was just so great, because they were able to get on and see it in the 3D and, work with it, manipulate it. So it was very important, yeah.
Well, and I think about this. Reagan, unfortunately, wasn't able to join us because she's in class right now. But when I spoke to her about this earlier this morning, that was what stood out to me, was she said what she really liked about it. It was interesting. When I asked her what she learned, she obviously did not talk about these things. She didn't say, I learned mapping skills and spatial skills. But what she said is, I liked that I could solve a problem with my friends. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, Shannon, from your perspective as a teacher, how important you think it is just to have those, I guess we can call them soft skills, but how important it is for them to be learning that alongside the software.
Oh, soft skill or not, that's one of the most important things. That's what we do for the rest of our lives. That's what they will do as adults. You know, you have to be able to work with other people, find a solution, work together, problem solve. I mean, that's where we're going. You know, that's where we want these kids to get to be successful. So they did have this program as an avenue to do that. But, we try to do that every day in all activities,
mm-hmm.
too.
I wonder if you think that also the other thing that Reagan said when I spoke to her was that she does a lot of computer work, but the fact that it was she spends a lot of time on the computer in the classroom doing lots of different things. But the fact that she was working together with people on the computer as a computer program to problem solve. Do you think that also that collaborative learning helps retention as well, that it helps them learn these lessons a little bit better?
Oh, absolutely. Anytime you can get a visual or hands-on lesson in front of them instead of just the reading and the worksheets, absolutely, kids will retain it. So, we try to do as much of that as possible.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's fifth grade teacher Shannon McLeod. May and Jonathan, a question for you, because Jonathan, you're in geography.
Right.
May, you are in education. How common is it for you all to have sort of an interdisciplinary approach to developing this different curriculum? Is that a typical thing?
For me, it definitely is. Geography is very interdisciplinary. I try to work with as many people in as many different departments as I possibly can. So, if geography is the ability to think spatially and you're trying to use that skill set to solve problems, we work with businesses trying to get products to customers. What's the most efficient route to move things? Where is the place to release animals? We've talked about examples like that. But where are invasive insects going next? So We do a lot of collaboration in geography.
Well, and when we think about that, as we think about these skills that, that the students are learning, these spatial skills, why do you think this is an important thing, Jonathan, for the future? For, and I guess not to be cynical, but if everybody sort of has different GPS systems on their phones or they learn how to read, like, why do we need to learn how to read maps?
Well, first off, the GPS came from somebody who knew how to read a map.
That's true.
Right? And they're assuming that you can look at the map and figure
and
out
follow
where it's going.
Right. Which I feel like most people can't do anymore, though, because simply because they have the technology that does it for them.
Sure. I would agree with that. But the technology is limited to solving the solution that the designer had in mind, right? I have a GPS in my car, and I use it for driving around when I don't know where I'm going. But that only helps me in that scenario. That doesn't help me decide where to release Buttons the Box Turtle, right? So your ability to think about relationships between places, that's a skill set that is going to become increasingly more critical. In fact, I think the U.S. Department of Labor predicts it'll be one of the fastest growing career options in the future. You know, everybody has Siri. Everybody says to Siri, Siri, where's the closest Starbucks, right? And then computer magic happens, and Siri tells us where it is.
Right.
But the process of how that works, and what does closest mean? Are you on foot? Does the closest mean you have to swim across the river, or is there one that's closer than the bridge? I mean, there's a lot of critical thinking involved in moving things across the Earth's surface that does not come intuitively unless you have been trained to do it.
Well, and as we think about that, that intuitive thinking, how important is it to teach young men and women, elementary school students, this at an early age? Jonathan?
I think it's really important. There are times, even in my college classes, when I want to talk to students about an idea. So, for example, in my biogeography class right now, I really want to talk to them about the importance of populations of wild organisms that are close to each other. So they don't interact often, but they do enough that they're part of the same population. And there are so many concepts associated with that simple idea that can only be seen spatially if you understand how to use a map and if you understand how to ask a digital map questions. And if I had to teach my students those skills, I would take the whole semester teaching them how to use the tools, and then the semester would end before we could talk about the impact they have on animal populations.
And is there a difference between the way young men and women, or I guess boys and girls, learn this?
Based on research that we looked at, there are basic differences from the get-go, from birth. And those differences, if not attended to, can get larger. So that's why we decided to work with children as early as possible, and we decided upper elementary grades was a good time to interact with children because they are capable of problem solving. They read to learn instead of learn to read. They are able, because of their mental functioning skills, are able to interact with computers in ways that allows them to learn something new and problem solve. So absolutely, the difference is there, and especially it is in particular in spatial rotation. Other spatial differences are not that big between girls and boys, but it is in spatial rotation in particular. So the program has been allowing us to introduce spatial thinking to both girls and boys early enough to allow them to develop these skills that will hopefully help them be better capable of working with even more challenging situations in not only in middle school and high school, but also in college.
May, really quickly, we just have about a minute left, but this is the last year of the three-year grant. What happens next?
We are hoping to work with more school districts and find ways to develop a more sustainable and workable training curriculum for teachers, meaning that they have video tutorials that allows them to learn how to use the modules that we developed and disseminate the concepts and ideas further than the schools, districts that we worked with so far.
Mm-hmm. And if so, if people want to reach out to you, we'll have all the information on our website at 21stshow.org. May Jadala, thanks for being with us, an associate professor of education at Illinois State University. Thanks also to Jonathan Thain, associate press professor of geography, joining us from GLT in Bloomington Normal. Shannon McLeod, thanks also to you as well. You teach fifth grade at Du Bois Elementary School in Springfield. Shannon, are you going to try to use this curriculum again? You want to try to continue to use these modules?
We absolutely will. Yep. I have that in my plans for next year, and we'll use it as long as we can.
Thanks for being with us. Speaking of mapping, we're going to be talking about that on Friday's show. We're learning about how GIS technology can help us understand how illnesses are spread. You're listening to The 21st.